Hi, Mike. We've spoken only a couple of days ago, and as a result of you and some other scientists taking a closer look at the so-called lots or batches, which, as you describe it, and this is our legal analysis as well, is compelling evidence for premeditated mass murder. You had prepared a presentation, which we never looked at, but do you have it with you now?
I don't on my end, but what I'd like to do briefly, Ryan, it was just for those who haven't seen me before, I want to establish my credentials and push back a little bit on some criticisms I've had, and then just step through what I have observed happening because of the, as it were, from a scientific perspective, and then say what I think is happening. And there are a couple of bits of evidence. So that will just like set the ground rules for 10 minutes or so.
Sure.
And then, yeah, I want to go into the very alarming results of analysis of the VAERS data as it pertains to the vaccine lots, and I've got a lot to say about that. So maybe Corvin would be able to find that short presentation that I sent, I think, for Wednesday's discussion. Maybe we can throw that up. If not, maybe append it to this recording or however you normally do show notes or whatever they call it. So, okay, well, thank you for the opportunity again to speak to you, Ryan. I think I mentioned when we spoke, I think, in the summer, that what your team is doing is, of course, completely unique. I don't think there's anywhere else on the planet that's spoken to between 100 and 200 experts each in their field and recorded an hour or more of their analysis of the situation. So, you know, hopefully in combination, it's going to make sense. So I'm Dr. Mike Yeadon. I describe myself as an industry veteran. I've worked in the biopharmaceutical industry for all of my life. My first degree was biochemistry and toxicology. English people don't like to brag, but I'm told I should. I was top of the year by a very long way. As an undergraduate, I worked under military clearance at Portendown. That's the equivalent, I guess, of Fort Detrick. It's where the UK military develops its so-called chemical defences. So I was under the Official Secret Act. They must have thought I wasn't a crazy person at the time. I also worked for 6 months at the Police Forensic Service headquarters at Aldermaston. So I learned a lot of analytical techniques in that time. Then I did a research-based PhD in respiratory pharmacology. And then after that, I jumped into industry. I had seven happy years at the Wellcome Research Labs before they closed after being acquired by Glaxo. So my career spanned the consolidation phase of pharmaceutical companies, and we call it the dirty snowball. You know, companies became absolutely huge, and that's relevant to what's happening today. They are so large, so powerful. So after that, I went to Pfizer in the UK at their very famous Sandwich Kent research based. I think more blockbuster drugs were discovered and released from that lab than any other single establishment on the planet. I wish I could claim I had anything to do with it, but I didn't. But what it did do is give me the opportunity to learn, as it were, at the knee of great drug discoverers, people who actually conceived, you know, led programs, invented molecules, developed them, gone through safety testing and launched them, and they're all made more than $1 billion a year thereafter. So it's a really good place for learning this trade. At Pfizer, I left in 2011, having been head of respiratory research worldwide. So I was their chief scientific officer for that therapy area, allergy and respiratory. I left because they closed the site in 2011. I played an important role, I think, in helping some of those programs and some staff move to new homes. So the world's second largest generics company, Mylan, acquired some space on that research park and hired many of my former colleagues. And obviously, I didn't do the deal, but I had, I think, something to do with pitching it to the company. Over the next 10 years to today, I've been a consultant to startup and mid-phase biotech companies. Some are now public, others privately held, and that's about 30 companies, mostly in the field of respiratory or inflammation, immunology, that kind of thing. And in the middle of that 10-year period, I had the opportunity to start my own biotech company with three other colleagues, and to raise some money, private venture capital, and to acquire some compounds from my former portfolio because Pfizer was closing the site down and indeed shrinking its footprint. That was quite a common model in the 10 years ago. So that's me. I think I have broad biological discipline and understanding necessary for doing research. So that's understanding disease and mechanisms well enough to contemplate intervention points that could help slow down a disease or ameliorate symptoms. And to do so safely. That was always the number one watchword. So some people have said, why are you speaking out? You're a crazy person, whatever. The three things I would say most commonly attributed to me, which are not true, but I will take them. He's a bitter ex-employee. Well, one, I left 10 years ago. I don't hold a grudge, and certainly not for 10 years. Secondly, Pfizer and I got on really well. I would say to this day that it's the best employer I ever worked for. It's a fantastic place to work for the reasons I described. Something's gone wrong since, obviously, but I was unhappy that I had to leave. They were very good to me. I was one of the last employees off the site because I was helping place people and projects. So that doesn't sound like a bitter person. They also treated me very well in terms of redundancy because I was a vice president and they tried to do that. And then, as I've said, a year after leaving, I came back with money and a lawyer and did a deal with them. And then 2 years later, they put additional capital in. That doesn't sound like we're getting on badly. And in 2017, when Novartis acquired Ziarko, my biotech, they made an undisclosed sum that I would say would make them very happy. They definitely did a good deal. So that was 5 years ago, and I'd had no interaction with them since. So, I'm not bitter, and I was very lucky to make some money. That's what has allowed me to be independent, by the way. Others have said I'm seeking fame. Well, no, I'm, despite the fact I can appear on TV or on camera, I'm actually by nature quite a shy person. If you left me to my own devices, I'd be tinkering with motorbikes in a shed, probably. That's what I like to do. And others say, well, he's making money. No, there's not a single thing I've ever done that is so-called monetized. And indeed, I probably lost hundreds of thousands of pounds being thrown off scientific advisory boards of former clients when they said you've become the story and it's not acceptable, which I understood. So it's costing me money. It's hurting my reputation. And I had every reason just to stay at home and enjoy my early retirement. No, the reason I'm speaking out is because I noticed advisors to the UK government lying on directly on television. And first it was just kind of fascinating, but through the spring and into the summer of 2020, I became first alarmed and then later in the year frightened, and I still remain frightened. Why? Every country in the world had what was called a pandemic preparedness plan for things like this, or influenza more typically. And I read them. I read all of them, maybe 20 from G20 countries plus the WHO. And in essence, they have only two things to recommend. One, if you are symptomatic, please stay home and away from other people until you're better. And that's because we've known for decades that symptomatic people drive respiratory viral infections, their epidemics. And the other measure was wash your hands more frequently than usual, because with any new pathogen, we don't understand transmission properly. So that's a good precaution. The next nine pages of these pandemic plans involved telling us what they shouldn't do. None of them involved border closures, unless you lived on a small island, school closures, business closures, mass testing of the well, lockdown, masking, anything like that. None of them. Absolutely all of the things that we have been told are essential were missing and explicitly ruled out by the previous plans. So I would say the strongest evidence I can offer for my assertion that there is a supranational plan to take over all of the liberal democracies is this, that all of the countries had somewhat similar pandemic preparedness plans that were very simple, and they all discarded them in the weeks of March 2020, all of them. And they replaced them with the same narrative script. And I'll just describe them. I call them the eight COVID lies. Every single one of them is an untruth And I think the objective was to frighten people to death, and I think it's worked. So how could it possibly be that Germany, Italy, the United States, Iceland, Scandinavian countries have all got the same bunch of wrong information all at the same time? And I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, there's only one way that could happen, and that's if they all agreed to do it beforehand, really. And so these lies, I'm not going to take a lot of time on them today, because there was a very long recording with the program called Highwire with Dell Bigtree about a year ago. And I go through them in painful detail. But what did they say? Well, they told us things like, this is an extremely lethal virus. If you catch it and get ill, you really could die. And remember the falling man face down in Wuhan. It's never happened anywhere else. It was pure theater. And it turns out that it's not a particularly lethal virus. If it exists at all, it's about the same as a bad seasonal influenza. They used PCR testing repeatedly off swabs up noses and throats and led you to believe that these were highly accurate and could distinguish a clinically infected person from something that's not. And even the inventor, Carrie Mullis, who's died, won a Nobel Prize for this technique, said you should never use it for this purpose. So I won't waste any more time, but they're still using these damn tests. And they're not reliable. They don't tell you anything, really. They also say you should wear masks, but masks have been extensively studied. Cloth masks, if anything, make you more likely to catch an unusual bacterial pneumonia because you're breathing through a filthy cloth. And the blue medical masks, they're not masks, actually. They're splash guards. Their purpose in hospitals is to stop blood and bodily fluid going into the nose and mouth of the attending healthcare worker. They've never been for filtering your breath, and obviously they don't do so. But they told you to wear masks, and I think the purpose, certainly in me, it causes anxiety. I feel really awful wearing these things. Then they introduced lockdowns where you were all to stay at home, mostly, unless you were a poor manual worker, and then you had to go out to work. But the intelligentsia pretty much got paid to stay at home for very long periods of time, 3 months initially in the case of Britain. Lockdowns, they told us, would slow the spread of transmission of this virus. And lots of people thought it must obviously be so because it's a disease spread from person to person. But it didn't chime with me. And I'm embarrassed to say it took me months to realize why they wouldn't work. And it comes to this next lie, the idea that of asymptomatic transmission, that you could be bearing the virus in your airways, yet have no symptoms, but nevertheless be able to spread enough of the stuff to infect a person nearby. That's not true. That's a flat lie. And whenever a scientific advisor, medical advisor to a government tells you things like asymptomatic transmission, I want you to know that they're not mistaken. They're lying because it's been studied and it's simply not true. And I can append a link to the notes for this program, which is an accumulation of statements by Fauci, a WHO doctor, and other people, actually, including me, goes through this argument. So if asymptomatic transmission doesn't occur, and I am certain it's epidemiologically irrelevant, I'm not saying it never occurs, but it's irrelevant. If it's irrelevant, why would you need to wear masks if you're well? Why would you need to test somebody who's not got symptoms? Why would you need to close your business or your school or the economy? So again, they've lied to you, with the objective of both frightening you and I think also learning from financially experienced people. The other objective was to begin to destroy the economy and the sovereign currencies. And I think that's a continuing objective. They also lied to us and told us that there were no treatments for this respiratory viral infection. And I will take my hat off to Dr. Peter McCulloch, as a leader, but he's representative of very many brave physicians who pushed back on this nihilism. And they have determined half a dozen really quite good therapies used progressively. So early on, you want to treat replication, in the middle phase, inflammation, and in the terminal phase, coagulation. And if you understand this multi-phase infection, you come to the conclusion, which is mine, that this is the most treatable respiratory viral illness ever. It's really quite surprising. But the use of those treatments are denied almost all around the world to the extent that people will be fined or even struck off as physicians. There's another lie there. And then they would say things like, well, we're not sure when you've had it, if you've become immune. Well, I would say immunology 101 tells you that that's simply not true. We know that the default understanding would be once you've shrugged off this virus, you will have taken high resolution pictures of it, as it were, using your immune system. And if you see it again or something related to it, like a variant, you will not get clinically ill, not for months, possibly many years. So that's another lie. And then the final one, and we'll come back to this, is that the vaccines are safe and effective, but that's a whole other story. So I've said that the evidence of a supranational plan is the discarding of simple, well-established pandemic preparedness plans and replacing them with this bunch of lies. And all the countries did it. And if someone would like to write to me with an explanation, an innocent explanation for this, I'd love to hear it. I want to be wrong, but unfortunately, I don't think I am. So if the motive is fear, I think the ultimate aim is control. And we will come onto this. The control mechanism that we can see being installed all around us are the so-called vaccine passports, a certificate first on paper and eventually a QR code on your phone that tells anyone who needs to know that you have received the requisite number of doses of these materials. And again, we'll come back to this, but it's again, that's nonsense. Economic destruction, I think, is on its way. There was a person who's very experienced in the City of London, and I heard them phoning into a radio show 3 weeks ago. And they said, I don't know anything about viruses, they said, but I do know a lot about finance. And they said, the amount of money, it's not even being borrowed, they've just printed it, actually created new money with an IOU from the government. They haven't sold gilt-edged certificates to investors. He said, it is my view that the sovereign currency is already destroyed. And the exchange rates ought to be moving violently against each other, and they're not, if you go and look. And that's because, as Catherine Austin Fitz tells us, this is a conspiracy led by the central banking clique and their clients to take over the world, I think. Once they've done that, destroyed the economy, again, I'm paraphrasing from Catherine, a great financial reset, which will have us using our vax passes, a digital ID, and central bank digital currencies, CBDCs, which you can look up. They are real, and they are being talked about by all central banks. You won't like those. You really won't. It'll be the end of cash and of any privacy of any transaction. And I know I go further than many, but I'm really quite concerned that there is a serious intent to kill a very large proportion of the population of the world. Again, I hope I'm wrong, but all of the measures required to get to this point of control through vaccine passports, digital ID, also, and to repeatedly vaccinate people, as we'll come on to, they certainly set the scene where a bad actor could introduce a gene sequence that will rob you of your health and kill you in a fairly predictable way at a fairly predictable rate per million doses and so on. So if somebody does want to depopulate, the setup is so perfect that it isn't completely crazy. Before I move on to the vaccines, and this is a concern I had, lots of people have said to me, Mike, this cannot possibly be the way you describe it. It looks compelling, I understand, but come on, you can't have a global conspiracy like this. It would leak, and it involves far too many people. You know, you must be wrong, there must be another explanation. And I suggest to them that they look for a video on YouTube, surprisingly, by a German journalist called Paul Schreier, S-T-H-R-E-Y-E-R, Paul Schreier. And there's a one-hour documentary called Pandemic Simulations, Preparation for a New Era, ? And when you watch that, your last rickety defense is that this isn't a well-organized, long-planned event, I think will disappear, and your heart will be in your boots by 20 minutes. Basically, all of the actors that you see around the table, including, say, an event 201 that took place at the end of 2019. All of those players are currently taking the roles they had in the simulations and all around the world and doing exactly the things they did in the simulation. So that was the rehearsal. Those were the rehearsals, and there were more than a dozen of these damn things. And I think one of the bitterest moments for me was to realise that we were doing it to ourselves, that the US, UK, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, the Five Eyes, I think, are the leading players. I don't know. I'm not going to say Russia's not involved or whatever, but it looks like the Edward Bernays School of Psychological Management has been used by the military intelligence people, and they've directed their weapons at their own people for 2 years through all these lies, repetitive messaging. And what we want to do is to wake people up, because if we don't wake up, we are finished as a set of liberal democracies. I'm going to turn to the vaccines, but before I do that, I'll pause in case Ryan or others would want to steer me differently. But I'll say two things that they're not original sayings, but they strike me as very appropriate. I've seen on many message boards, when this all comes out, don't ask me how I knew. Ask yourself why you didn't. I mean, honestly, the evidence that things are amiss, I think, is so stark that you literally have to avert your eyes not to realize that things are really bad everywhere. And then this other thing is an old saying. I've heard this before. It makes me chuckle a little bit. If you're one step ahead of everybody else, you can be seen as a genius. If you're two steps ahead, you're a lunatic. And that's, I'm afraid, what I've been. My job as a scientist was to spot faint patterns in sparse data. That's what you do when you're trying to work out something that's new. And so I think I have been a couple of steps ahead and probably sometimes wrong, but broadly, I think it is sadly roughly what I've said. Rainer, you can either wave me onwards or you might want to ask any questions about that.
Mike, you're right on track. This okay. It's so important to hear this little introduction because it gives us an overview. Many of our viewers have only seen bits and pieces of this, so this gives them the whole picture. This is great. You're right on track.
All right. Thank you. And Corvin, if you could have the presentation available, I'll talk for a little bit and then maybe we can pop those slides up because, I'll come back to that. It's a colleague's done an analysis that's, I think, quite striking when you see that. So to the vaccines. So I worked for the biopharmaceutical industry for 32 years. So I think you can take it as read, but I'll say it again. I am pro-innovative new medicines, provided they're well-developed, used appropriately, and, of course, the profile is safe enough, considering the utility. So if you were treating a terminal cancer that had evaded surgery, current chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and so on, then you might be willing to take a drug that might kill 10% of the people, 5%. If it might stretch your life out for many years, especially if you offer the chance of a cure. And some of these gene-based vaccines, I think the original intent of people like Dr. Malone and others was indeed to treat things like that. You could put a protein from your cancer into one of these vaccines and force your immune system to recognize it and destroy it. And that could provide exquisitely safe, novel chemotherapy. But if you're going to treat effectively everyone on the planet, and you shouldn't do it anyway, but that's certainly the stated intent, you need safety, as Peter McCulloch would say. That's your first concern. Even better, even more than does it work, you need to make sure it's very safe, because you're going to be giving it potentially to billions of people. Now, I did say that my original training included toxicology, and I was taught by at least two people that founded the discipline of mechanistic toxicity. Can't remember their names now, Professor Jim Bridges and somebody else, Dennis Park. And they reminded us that in the 1950s, we didn't do toxicology in the drug industry. They would give it to two dogs and five chickens. And if the drug didn't kill them, they literally would start giving them to people. That's how bad things were 60 or 70 years ago. We had some strong wake-up calls at the end of the 60s, early 60s, with thalidomide, for example. It's a case that most people know about. At the time, they thought that babies were safe in mother's womb, and so wouldn't be a problem if you gave a pregnant woman a drug. And we now know that their fetus is exquisitely sensitive to perturbations in their environment. And so we never, ever give novel medical interventions to pregnant women, right? We'll come back to that, so we're definitely doing that. So because of my toxicological training and sort of a good understanding of what was required in drug R&D, new drug R&D, as soon as I looked at the vaccines, I was really quite frightened, because they were a novel type. These have never been mass dosed to human beings at all. So there would be no way of knowing what kind of effects, unwanted effects, might come about. And of course, what you do is careful empirical study. You should do all of the possible studies that, if you have a worry, you know, rule of thumb would be, if you can think of a worry, you need to show why it's not going to happen. So you design an appropriate experiment. You have to try and drown your own puppy, as we used to call it. It's not a good job, but you have to do it. You can't just hope it'll be all right on the night. It rarely is. And when I looked at the vaccines, I had a number of concerns. One was all four of them. So that was the Janssen, J&J, AstraZeneca, Pfizer and Moderna. They all were fundamentally the same design, whether they used mRNA or a viral communicated DNA. They encoded only the spike protein, the sort of sticky out bit from the ball and stick model of the virus that you've got. And I don't know to this day how they all chose just the spike protein, because I guessed, and we now know it's true, that human immunity relies much more on understanding the depth, the sort of the molecular structure inside the ball than the spikes. So I thought it was bad, just immunologically uneducated thing, just to pick the outside part. But secondly, it took me, I don't know, no more than half an hour of searching for research papers, abstracts, and so on. Not so much on coronavirus spike protein, because it's relatively new, but similar external proteins on other viruses. And within the half an hour, I realized that all of them have some kind of biological properties that are unwelcome. They're not just for anchoring the virus to the surface of a cell, which they do, but they're also biologically active, as you might expect, really. They interact with the immune system and also coagulation system. So, in fact, I saw Wolfgang Brodarg earlier, and he led off, and I joined a two-person appeal, a petition to the European Medicines Agency to say, don't approve these vaccines at this time. Here are a handful of concerns that we think are going to occur, and you need to slow down. And I think two of the four have been tested and proved correct, and the third one was looking pretty ropey. So the design of them, I would say, it was toxic by design. It was always going to harm people. Next, unlike a classical vaccine, which is usually a killed piece or killed preparation of the infective organism in a little bit of oil or alum, something like that. That's a unit dose, so you know how much you're injecting into each person. With these vaccines, we're giving a unit dose of code. Now, that code could be taken up well, copied into protein very efficiently, and might do so for a long time in one person. In another person, it might be taken up badly, copied inefficiently and only briefly. So what I'm saying, and I'm absolutely certain about this as a pharmacologist and a toxicologist, is by choosing this design, the range of outcomes is probably 1,000 times worse than it would be for a conventional vaccine, because, you know, the actual amount of protein produced will vary by orders of magnitude more. It will. And I thought that was the explanation for why it is that many people had no side effects whatsoever, and others appeared to die. You know, people would say, how could that possibly be true? And I just explained it, that with an encoded vaccine, an unlucky individual might take up large quantities of it in their heart, in the coronary vessels, or in the cerebral veins in their head, and produce lots of spike protein for a long time. And those people might get myocarditis or cerebral vein sinus thrombosis and die. And someone else, it might be spread around the body in a sort of less dangerous place and not make so much spike protein. I thought that was an adequate explanation, but I don't think that's not the whole explanation anymore. The reason I thought it was an explanation was I made an assumption, which I was entitled to make, which is that the same stuff from a given manufacturer is in every single vial. You know, little glass vaccine vial. I believed and was entitled to believe that within a fraction of a percent, we had the same consistent quality and purity in every single injection. And therefore, the observed variation in behavior in people must be down to something such as the thing I just suggested. But and as I'm going to come on to, unfortunately, we're now absolutely certain it's not the same stuff in every vial. And that means criminal acts are being committed. So we will come on to that. Just before we do that, vaccines. Normally, a vaccine, if you administer it to a person, would usually be one dose, sometimes two. It's never going to be a whole train of them. I'm seeing some countries already given the fourth vaccine, and others have talked about an open-ended series. You need to know, vaccines are not like that. You do not need to be repeatedly dosed with something that would earn the title vaccine. One or two doses at most. So if it's more than that, it's not public health, and it's not public health. So, but here's the thing: a vaccine ought to, at minimum, I think, prevent you becoming ill with the pathogen against which you've been vaccinated. If it doesn't do that, I'm afraid it's not a vaccine. And as a consequence of protecting you against that organism, and it does that usually by killing off a new infection in an early stage before you're even symptomatic, that would mean you should have low viral load in your airway. So that's what keeps you safe after vaccination, or if you've acquired immunity. And the consequence of that is it usually reduces, if not stops, transmission. And we know now, lots of work in the literature, that people who've had this virus are immune to becoming ill a second time from, you know, either the original virus or a variant. And they don't transmit either. So we can see what immunity, good immunity, can look like, because we've seen lots of cases of natural immunity. And authorities do agree. They concede that these vaccines do not prevent you catching it. They don't prevent you growing the same amount in your airway as an unvaccinated person, and they don't prevent transmission. So if someone's going to claim that they reduce the severity of your symptoms, I'd like to know what black magic is invoked, because I've just told you, it goes to your airway, it grows in the same way and transmits in the same way. I actually don't believe there's no mechanism now for this to suddenly intervene and stop you getting ill. I don't believe it. So I think most likely outcome now is they don't do anything useful at all, but they are unfortunately really very harmful. They're certainly toxic. So just a brief introduction, I think, to one of the best tracking systems in the world, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS. It's a US system. It was put in place about 30 years ago. And anyone who has an adverse event following vaccination, you know, even if they don't, not necessarily claiming it's necessarily caused by it, but in order to track the possibility, you're urged to report that. But unfortunately, the reporting rate is typically between 1% and 10% of adverse events. And there's every piece of evidence that has continued, you know, in the recent year since the vaccine started rolling out. And yet there have been more adverse events and certainly many more deaths associated just with the COVID-19 vaccines than all the other vaccines, you know, in history that have been taken through this VAERS system. So there is no question, it's public data, it's your database. It's not mine, I haven't put anything in it. 85% of the reports were put in there by a qualified healthcare professional. So it's not true, as some have asserted, that, well, people are just putting in, you know, spoiler claims and they're not real. They're absolutely real. There is something called it's often said that correlation is not causation, and that's true. Just because there's lots of reports doesn't necessarily mean that it's the vaccine. But there are things called Bradford Hill criteria. So you can look up the Bradford Hill criteria on Google or duck.go. I think there are 11 of them. And it gives you methods whereby you can determine whether the correlation is indeed causative or not. So I'll just give you a quick example. If there is acute toxicity in a vaccine, then you would expect to see a spike in injuries and deaths in the first few days after administration. If there's no connection whatsoever, then you would expect a much more smooth, low-level profile that would pay not much attention to when you were vaccinated. And when you look at it, I think more than a third of the adverse events occur on the day of dosing or the next 2 days, and then it rapidly falls off. So that's one of the Bradford Hill criteria. Another one, I'll only mention this other one, is plausibility. If you have a theoretical reason for believing that it'll make your left leg turn blue, and, you know, you look at the adverse events and look, it's lots of blue left legs, that's much more compelling than if someone ended up with, say, a sore elbow, for which you had no predictive power. And what I would say is on this occasion, we believe that these agents cause so-called thromboembolic disorder. So they affect coagulation and you may bleed or clot. And so any vessels that are plugged up by clots, like strokes or heart attacks, deep vein thrombosis, or bleeding like subarachnoid hemorrhage, any of those things are what you would predict. And lo and behold, they are present in VAERS at enormous numbers, unprecedented numbers. So the timing and the plausibility convinces me that these are causative, mostly they are causative. And other people who are used to doing this, pathologists and others, have done a very thorough job. And unfortunately, it's definitely causative. Large numbers, and it's causative. Where it comes to vaccines, wouldn't you expect, now I put it to you, you would expect them to be deployed not just first, but only in the people who are at extraordinary risk from the pathogen. So in this case, we know it's elderly people who are already frail. And that's how they started. But very swiftly, they started coming down to the working age population, you know, 50s, 40s. And as you're probably aware, we've now been trying to encourage people to get their children vaccinated. Now, I don't know about your part of the world, but in Sweden and Germany, I looked at the public record, not one healthy child has died as a consequence of being infected by this virus. Not one. So if I tell you that there are novel technology agents that are being proposed to be injected into your child, a child who's not at any risk from the virus and who also are very poor at transmitting it to other people because they generally don't get symptoms. And I just told you earlier about asymptomatic transmission is a lie. So please, I'm begging of you, whatever your neighbours say or your school teacher or your government advisor, I'm afraid they're lying or mistaken. You must not vaccinate your children. So we should target these interventions to those who might benefit from them because they generally will be willing to bear whatever the side effects are in exchange for that benefit. So healthy younger people, certainly 60 and down, really should not even have been on the map for vaccination because they survive. Secondly, there are really good treatments, as I've mentioned. With good therapies and people's strong immune system, if they're younger and well, there was no need to vaccinate the world. And then I've mentioned children. Yes, pregnant women. I've made a special examination of this from my toxicological background. And I was just appalled when I heard a leading doctor, I think, from the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynaecology in London. The Royal College is meant to be the acme of medical quality, hopefully in ethics. And this woman appeared on national radio and proceeded to tell people that if they were pregnant, they really should get vaccinated. And don't worry, these are perfectly safe. And I'll look you in the eye now and tell you that the studies have not been done to examine the safety of these vaccines in pregnancy. There's been no formal study. And there's no reproductive toxicology package is complete in industry. And I worked in industry for 32 years. I can tell you, we were not allowed to dose healthy female volunteers of childbearing age without insisting that they used highly effective contraceptive methods. And generally, we didn't do it at all. We just didn't do it until we had reproductive toxicology because we were all rightly fearful of the potential to damage a growing baby. So it's literally nonsense. This is one of those things you should wake up to. You know, any listener knows that thalidomide changed the landscape forever in terms of precautions, in terms of medications in pregnant women for the reasons we understand. And so if your country's policy includes encouraging pregnant women to get vaccinated when they are by definition relatively young and relatively well, or they probably wouldn't have got pregnant and therefore not likely to suffer severe effects of the virus. And why would it make any sense to administer these experimental therapies? And then worse than that, I've written affidavits and opinions to say there are two or three lines of evidence that would lead me to be extremely concerned for the potential for harms. And unfortunately, it actually does look like we were right about that. But I'm not going to push it any further. But that my main point in just what I said in the last few minutes, I've drifted a little bit, is just to say if this was a public health measure, he would only administer these vaccines to people who could benefit most from it, so the people who are most likely to get ill and die. And that would exclude healthy young people. It would certainly exclude children. It would definitely exclude pregnant women. And here's the other thing. It would definitely exclude anyone who's had the virus and recovered. There are scores of papers showing that people who've had the virus and recovered have a full complement of T cells of multiple types. That means that they will recognize the virus and any variants and remain well. And that is, in fact, the empirical observation. So when you see your governments threatening the unvaccinated, including people who've recovered, they are more immune than the people who've been vaccinated. So I just don't understand how anyone can go on about being, as it were, anti-vax. No, I'm anti-conspiracy theory. I'm anti-conspiracy fact. That's what's going on. So then moving on to the hot lots. So I mentioned earlier that I came up with an explanation for why many people have no side effects and some people get very ill and even die. And that might be true. But the reason I even thought of it was that you should expect pharmaceutical mass manufacturers to be good at least at one thing, and they are very good at this: consistent, high quality, purity manufacture from batch to batch to batch. They're very good at this because that's what their business is. They manufacture tablets, capsules, sprays, and injections in the billions of doses. If you think of something like Lipitor, a cholesterol lowering drug, it's given to a substantial minority of the population in older age, one tablet a day forever. They would have made tens of billions of doses. Not easy to make these genetic vaccines, but making a few hundred million, I think, would be absolutely in the wheelhouse of Janssen, J&J, and Pfizer, at least. Moderna was a new company, so I can't say. But I trusted that these companies were doing what I knew they were very good at doing, what they did for their business. And then I stumbled across a couple of people independently who'd been doing their own analysis of the VAERS database. What they were doing, and no one else seemed to have done it, was they were pulling the vaccine batch or lot number. It might be like 8 digits, 6 digits, a mixture of alphanumeric symbols. And comparing the profile of adverse events with comparing one lot to another lot to another lot with the same manufacturer. And their expectation would be there would be like a scattering of adverse events across all the states and all of the lots. But they didn't find that. This person found that something like 90% of the adverse events were associated with like less than 10% of the lots. And I remember seeing that some months ago, and I immediately knew the significance of it, because as I've said, although I'm not in any way a manufacturing expert, I worked for decades with people who were, and I knew their pride and the necessity of meeting the sort of anti-adulteration regulations, which require, tremendously reproducible product from lot to lot to lot. And so I'll just briefly describe manufacturing of medical products like this proceeds in two steps. The first step is to make the active molecule. In this case, it would be mRNA or DNA with an attenuated virus. So we would think of that as the first step. It's drug substance. It's the actual active component. And then once you've got that, it will generally be formulated in some way. In this case, it's going to be in some sort of dilution material. It might be medical saline. Sometimes, though, it'll be mixed up with binding agents, colorings, lubricants, shiny coats on a capsule or a tablet. And that's called drug product. So the first step is to make the active, and the second step is to formulate it and finish with the drug product. Now, each of those steps is associated with a series of acts. You might start with a raw material, two raw materials, and then warm them up and manufacture a third product, and then purify that. And that might be a step. And the manufacturer submits to the regulator its pharmaceutical production plan. And each of those steps has gone through by experts and the regulator, and they agree that the steps are appropriate and that the limits, the range of outcomes on testing are appropriate. And only if they are would you be permitted to go to step 2, 3, 4, 5 until you've completed all the steps. So I'm elaborating a little bit to tell you that they don't just throw everything into a bucket like home brewing beer, stir it a bit, put it in the packet. this is done with just incredible levels of control. As you'd expect, you want it to be reproducible. So the effects of, if they follow the, what's called the good manufacturing practice or GMP manufacturing practices, as required by a medical regulator, even for an emergency approved product, it would, it should be the case that the lots are effectively contain the same stuff, whether it, wherever it was made and whenever it was made, it'd be the same stuff. And I know they're capable of doing that. Now, if that's true, if you draw a lot at random from the VAERS system and examine the outcomes, the performance, that is the number of people who've reported adverse events, it ought to be pretty similar from batch to batch to batch. If it's very different, I'm afraid I can tell you with certainty, I would be able to prove this mathematically if needed in court, it's not possible to go from two or three adverse events reported for a given lot and another lot have 5,000 adverse events. It's not possible if you only vary the product a little bit. You know, you might imagine, well, they're doing this at speed and it's novel, it might be a bit hard on them. No, if you only had a small difference, you only get a small difference in the performance. If you go from nothing effectively to the worst outcomes ever reported to VAERS, I am prepared to state and to prove that that means it's not the same material in the lots that have produced bad side effects. I mean, what I've just told you, you may not appreciate the significance of it. It's not the same stuff. So if you thought it was the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine that was used in the clinical trials, some of the batches contain something different. I cannot know what it is, but it's definitely not the same stuff. So, yes, I think, Corvin, if you could just throw open that short presentation. I've run over it a little bit, but I think it visually will help people. You don't need very much. So as I've explained on this first slide, if it contains the same product, it, the performance should be pretty similar, just a little variation. But if you step forward, yeah. So I'm not the analyst. In fact, it's an irony. I'm the person speaking. I'm the only person not capable of doing the sort of information technology. But one reason I'm speaking is because of my deep experience in pharmaceutical research and development and knowledge from people who are experienced about manufacture. And what I've described is true. And also the people who are doing this work, we're self-starters, we've got a degree of independence, and we're all speaking out because something awful is happening. If we move to the next slide, please, Corbin. As I've mentioned again in my introduction, it's quite normal, I'm afraid, for every medicine will have some kind of side effect. I think it was a very old, ancient physician, I think Paracelsus, that said all medicines are poisons, it's just a question of dose. And that's kind of true, that rat poison used at very low doses, or its modern analogy, can be really useful to thin your blood. But that means you need consistency from dose to dose to dose. And it was true that in the first half of the 20th century, many pharmaceutical outfits that were probably quite small at the time were occasionally careless, if not outright reckless, and had adulterated products, that is, products that were not the same from tablet to tablet or injection to injection. And so that brought about sort of these FDA regulations that relate to so-called adulteration. And really, it's about reproducibility, purity, and so on. So next slide. Yes, so I think I've just said that. So for the lawyers, it's very important. My colleague who put this together taught me something I didn't know. Because those regulations were formed to make sure that badly manufactured products were never again foisted on the public, they said that if it's not made as you have described and made consistently, so there'll be a tiny variation, fraction of a percent perhaps, that's allowed batch to batch, we will declare it to be adulterated. And the thing is that adulteration per se, manufacturing and release of materials, which I assert and others in this team agree, are performing very differently one from another, by definition, means it's not the same stuff. By definition, it's adulterated. And I think by definition that they have broken various laws. Next slide, please. Yeah, so this is really important. Again, the initial analyst just looked at the COVID-19 lot numbers and just found that the side effects were not uniformly, even pseudo-uniformly spread across the lots. But what this other colleague has done is to say, well, look, let's compare, let's look at the thing that's most comparable. So she looked at all the injected products against influenza. And it turns out, as you can see, it's decades of data, and it's about 22, 23,000 lots, manufacturing lots. And if you look to the right, the COVID mRNA vaccines, five lines down, similar number, 25,000. So they're similar numbers of lots. But if you look at the serious adverse events, you can see like a five-fold difference there from 9,000 to 47,000. And in terms of deaths, I think that's like eight times worse. So something very peculiar is happening. We go to the next slide, please. Now, these next couple of slides are the crucial ones. So along the bottom there are the meaningless to me numbers associated with all these injectable flu vaccine products over many, many years. And on the vertical axis are the number of serious adverse events. And you can see there were just a couple of exceptions, one with about 22 serious adverse events. A serious adverse event is something that would bring you to hospital, extend your hospital stay, could threaten your life, require urgent intervention to save your life, something like that. These are not a sore arm or a bad headache. This is something really bad. But with the exception of the one on the left there with 23 serious adverse events, a lot might contain several tens of thousands of doses. We don't know what it is every time, but what we can say is that since the, as I'll show in a moment, since the number of adverse events can vary thousands of fold, it's not possible for the difference in batch size or lot size to be the whole explanation for the differences. Might contribute to it, but we've done some preliminary examination where we have managed to find out exactly how many doses there were in a group of lots. And when we looked at the relationship between the number of doses in the batch and the number of adverse events in the batch, there's no relationship. So that's not the driver. So with the flu vaccines, there were just two lots. We don't know why that was. Something went wrong, and there were a relatively large number, 22 and 37. But look at the rest, hundreds and hundreds, thousands, it's tens of thousands of lots where on average, my eye is telling me that the sort of smoothed average is around four serious adverse events per lot. But more importantly than that, I think you'll agree, it kind of looks like static, just, you know, it's a background noise. Remember, if you dose a large population, you could dose them with saline and get this effect because people do get ill. You might put on red socks today and have a heart attack. Obviously, the red socks didn't cause your heart attack. But if you were tracking the relationship between your new product with socks and side effects, you would end up with a product with a profile that looks like this. So side effects associated with an intervention does not necessarily mean that it's bad. As I mentioned earlier, this sort of correlation is not causation. But I wanted, and this is really good work by my colleague, I wanted to show you what we think is a normal, well-manufactured, consistent, high-quality product looks like in the real world when you give it to, you know, millions of people over time. So now with that established, and baseline is around four, and the highest value was 37, Corvin, if you could show us the next slide. I think it is the next slide, yes. So this, by now, should start to take your breath away. So these are the COVID vaccines. There are three manufacturers, because it's the US commercial utilities. So it's just these three. We don't know about AstraZeneca. But remember I said that the rolling average was about four adverse events. Well, you know, the scale on the y-axis here, you know, four is thicker than the axis, the thin blue line at the bottom is more than four. And the red line, this is the worst ever. You can see there was like a single case out of 22,300 flu vaccine batches that was 37. But really, that's probably, you know, way over what the representative. The representative was somewhere around four, but there you go. That's the top. Look how many batches of COVID products are worse than that. And yet, And yet, let me just point out, for example, right in the center there, 651 483 5461 looks like it's either, you know, one or two. And then it's neighbor one or two, it's neighbor one or two, it's neighbor one or two. And then suddenly you come on this one here, you know, EN6201, and it looks like it's 6600. Serious adverse events. Again, these are the ones that are, you know, notable. If you had a serious adverse event yourself, you would think, thank God I didn't die. It was quite close to death. And look at the number of them. And so a number of things I want to point out here. One is the extreme level of side effects that we're seeing, orders of magnitude. I would say just the rolling average here is looking like, I don't know, between 100 and 200 instead of four. That these are really toxic products. They really are toxic products, and that's bad enough. But as I argued, if you were a cancer sufferer, you might accept a dangerous intervention if on balance it could extend your life and its quality by a year or so. But these products have been given to the general public, most of whom are perfectly well. That's the normal deal with the vaccine. You're perfectly well. You turn up at the doctor's office, get an injection, and you leave, and you're still perfectly well. And all that's happened is you've acquired a defense against a specific pathogen. That's the deal. What we shouldn't have is that you occasionally get seriously ill and some of you die. That's not a good deal. That is what is happening from these products. And they're being pushed on everyone when, as I've argued, if you're recovered, infected, you're immune. If you're a child, you're not vulnerable to the virus. Just healthy young people not, and pregnant women, we do not know that it's safe and should not, on the precautionary principle, be administering it. And yet, your governments are pushing these on you. It's not a public health measure. If it was a public health measure, the three or four things I just said would be true. It's not a public health measure. And all of the stuff I said earlier about discarding normal pandemic handling plans and replacing them by absurd lies that have had the effect of frightening people, and we think that was the objective. Now you've seen this information and your economies are on the verge of absolute extinction. And I think that's the evil triumvirate. Frighten people, damage the economy, persuade them as necessary to accept these injections, some of which are killing people. Why would they want to do that? This is why I got to the conclusion. I racked my brain. There may be other explanations. It's not money, by the way. The pharmaceutical companies, of course, are having an absolute field, a high watermark in terms of profitability. That cannot be the motive. It's the effect of using big pharma to drive these products into the population. That can't be the motive. Why can't it be the motive? Because there are huge numbers of industry sectors that are absolutely almost into the ground. You know, the airline industry, I don't know how they're surviving. You know, almost 2 years of non-normal operation. Hotel and catering, holiday trade, and all of these things. So remember that the only people who could possibly make this happen, or at least have to agree in order that this happens in their world, would be the owners of, you know, the people who own what Catherine Austin Fitz calls, you know, Mr. Global, global big capital. So I'm absolutely sure that money alone, profit alone, is not the motivation, because there might be a couple of sectors doing really well, but eight sectors are doing so badly as to more than outweigh the benefits that accrue to the drug companies. But let's just go back to that slide, please, Corvin, if we could. Yeah, because there's something, not just is there this extreme toxicity, but it's the variability. Now, I pointed out, so let's just look at the Pfizer bunch, because there's a nice range there. Nice is the wrong word, sorry. I'm sounding like a scientist. These are people. These are people who've suffered, and some of whom have died. But as you cast your eye across the, across the axis at the bottom, you can see that some of the numbers there are associated with very small numbers. They're so small that you can't see it registering on the thickness of the x-axis marked, y-axis marked zero. And yet close to it, there are a whole bunch of batches that have got, 400, 600 serious adverse events per lot, and they're roughly the same size. That means there's not the same product. that's got this Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, it says on the box or on the vial, it's not the same stuff. It's not the same stuff. I'm certain. It's not an assessment. It's not maybe. I'm absolutely certain. There is something called the law of mass action, which applies to all biological properties I've ever seen. And if it does come to court, I will just walk you through the history of that and why it is that shape and why this means it cannot be the case that these middle Pfizer lots are the same material as the ones immediately to the left and to the right. These drug companies are highly professional outfits. They know how to manufacture reproducibly, and we saw that with the flu vaccines over decades. They know how to do it. They haven't done it. I'm afraid I've come to the conclusion that they're doing it on purpose because they're so professional. And after a year, they know this data. This data is it's their window onto the world. They can go into VAERS, they can filter for their own products and their own lot and batch numbers, and they can see what's happening. They know. So the fact they haven't stopped this tells me that they're at least okay with it. And I fear that this is deliberate. Why might it be? Why might it be deliberate? Well, as we have seen over the last 2 years, big techs like Google, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and so on have persistently said, we're not having anyone making a comment or a recording that disagrees with what the public health officials say, and we're going to call that misinformation, and we're going to basically, we'll censor you and maybe deplatform you. What that means is that a qualified person like me, and I promise I have no axe to grind whatsoever, other than telling you what I think is true, which is that we're facing a global crime. People like me cannot speak to the public because the tech companies have decided not to let me. And that's true of mainstream TV, mainstream radio. I've only ever appeared on radio where they maligned me. They've told me lots of lies. So I then threatened them, and then they deleted the recording, which tells you something, doesn't it? That I was correct. So it's the combination of big tech, big media, and by that I mean mainly TV around the world. They control what's coming into your house. So if you just turn your TV on over the last 2 years in the same way that you ever have, you're only going to hear a one-sided, and in my view, it's mendacious, it's completely misleading, description of what's going on. You'll never hear things like this. And you should see both sides of it. The fact that you're not allowed to, I think, tells you that they know there's something bad going on, and they're going to make damn sure that people like Dr. Mike Eden and Dr. Robert Malone and Dr. Peter McCulloch and so on will never darken the studios of BBC or CNBC. Because if we were given an hour, I think we could destroy this story easily. I think we're plausible, we're being honest. And I gain absolutely nothing from making up stories. I'm describing in horror. So I've said that the variability is extreme. And I've said that the media controls the message and they censor people like me. If they want to tell you that there's a nasty variant that's just come along that's killing more people than previously, you've no way of knowing if that's true or not. And I don't think you should trust anything they say about this, because they've definitely lied about everything else I've been able to hear. But let's say they did say that. Let's say they said there's a new variant or a new virus that's, say, 10 times more lethal than COVID. And don't worry, the innovative pharmaceutical industry has rustled up a new vaccine, and, you know, run and get your top up, your booster, your new vaccine. What happens if they chose to give you that one that's called EN6201 instead of the one to EN1201? Well, the answer is, you know, probably thousands of people are going to die. And imagine all the manufacturers doing that and over time and across the world. All the time, the media is giving you a very frightening message. And the appropriate response, if these guys were being honest, would be, okay, let's deploy these vaccines as we tune them and so on. But it's all lies. It's all misleading. And I worry that what you've seen in front of you there, I've described it to other people. I said, I'm worried that this is calibration of a killing weapon. That if somebody wanted to say that there are viruses or vaccines that are, say, 10 times more lethal than COVID, so killing 1 in 100 people instead of 1 in 1,000, roughly, they could just move along and just deploy batch X or batch Y or batch Z. And that's what would happen. And, you know, I've got no reason to make this stuff up. You know, I've never been a conspiracy theorist. If anything, I would be the sort of person that would chuckle at other people having conspiracy theories. And of course, now I realize what a mug I've been for the last 61 years believing what I've been told. So the bottom line, you can see it from here. It's not the same stuff in each glass bottle. That's an offense in all sorts of ways against the Adulterated Drugs Act. It cannot be accidental because they are professionals that know how to manufacture consistently. It's not possible that this is small variation in product because it's, you know, an emergency situation, difficult to make. No, the law of mass action would mean that in order to get these enormous differences in, quotes, performance, you know, serious adverse events, would have to have a very a sizable difference. I would say, I don't know, 10 to 100-fold difference in an active. If there was an active that produced these side effects, I'm confident, and we've did the experiments, and I'd be roughly right. I've done hundreds of experiments like that, not with people, of course. And, it, you know, we'd need to go up in dose by 30, 100, 300 to go from baseline to these numbers. I'm absolutely sure about that. I'd bet a lot of money on it. So because they're good at manufacturing, and because this data is available, it's been available to them all the time. They can look as the VA ERS data comes in. So they've known about this, and that means they're good with it. You know, they're good with it. So it's either intentional, or if it has proven too difficult to manufacture, they should still not be allowed to discharge these, as it were, into the public environment, because, you know, they're very lethal. I'm trying to think, there's something very important I was going to say. Yes. Some people have said to me, Mike, these are brand new products, as you've said. And early on we heard, I think the Pfizer product had to be stored at like minus 80 centigrade. So that means they're a bit unstable, rather unstable. Maybe, Mike, what's happening is they're just going off. Occasionally, you know, bad handling, people not used to the cold chain, what's called a cold chain like this. Well, I don't think that's true. One, when products degrade, they generally lose activity. A piece of it falls off. If you imagine a car degrading, might lose one wheel and the top part of the engine. It doesn't suddenly turn into a lethal, you know, flying machine. It will lose function. And that's what I would expect to happen. Now, on a one-off, yeah, maybe a novel product like this might break in half and you end up with two super toxic bits of mRNA. But we're seeing the same thing with three products made by three different companies. And we're seeing two different technologies. So Moderna and Pfizer are mRNA. The Janssen is a DNA. You know, no, it's not possible. I've just said the rule of thumb is degradation results in loss of function, not acquisition of exquisite toxicity. And we've got three products and two technologies doing that. No, that's not the explanation. And here's the thing, I have no idea what it is they have done, but I'm more frightened of these vaccines than I was before seeing this work with my colleague. So that's, I think that's the long and short of it, really. So all of the early stuff, you know, you're being lied to, and I can prove that in several occasions. And I would like, as I say, to direct people who haven't seen me before to my interview with Adele Bigtree on Highwire, and that I think will educate you on what I was seeing as the principal lies. And then I certainly would like to attach a short, I think it's 16 minutes with three or four people talking, that will provide you convincing evidence that the authorities knew that asymptomatic transmission was complete garbage. And if that's true, and it's true, it's garbage, everything else falls to pieces. And then when we come to the vaccines, if they were a public health measure, they'd be directed only to the people who most could get benefit from it, and never to children, healthy young people, pregnant women, and those who've already recovered. And yet, coach and horses has been driven right over those. So that's about where they are. And the reason I'm here is I want to work with anyone through the Corona Committee and anywhere else that can help wake people up, because I don't know how to fix this, but if enough people say, you know, we've had enough now, we're not going to comply with it anymore. I noticed in Northern England, there were a group of several thousand children from secondary school in Lancashire, and they formed a union. And Wolfgang and I were talking about unions a few days ago, and they just said, do you know what? We're not wearing stuff you. We're not wearing the mask to school anymore. And no, we're not going to put these cotton buds up our nose twice a week, not doing it anymore. And that's all we need to do, because I am telling you, there is no unusual threat in your environment except from your government and their policies and the pharmaceutical industry. There's nothing going on other than, you know, the sort of psychological warfare and you know, the economic damage, and then these wretched vaccines. So we can still take our old normal, hopefully in a better form, back, but it requires us to just take a little courage in our hand and say, I do not comply anymore. I do not comply. And you're not doing anyone any good by complying. You're not saving yourself. You're certainly not saving your children. So that's all you need to do. And they can't arrest everybody, right? One or two people decide to demonstrate they could be arrested. If 10,000 school children say, we're not going to school with masks and testing, you know, and they just cross their arms and say, what are you going to do then? You know, that's how you take it back. That's how we take it back. Anyway, I'll pause now because I've talked for quite a long time, I think.
Mike, can I ask you a question, Mike?
Yes.